Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. HRN is food radio supported by you. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org. This is Capri Cafaro, host of Eat Your Heartland Out. This week's episode is all about cookbooks that celebrate the flavors and culture of the Midwest. Paul Fehrbach joins the show to discuss his new cookbook, Midwestern Food, A Chef's Guide to the Surprising History of a Great American Cuisine. And we'll also welcome Amy Thielen to chat about her newest cookbook, Company, The Radical Art of Cooking for Others. Amy, we are so happy to have you back on Eat Your Heartland Out. You were one of my first guests, if not like the literal first guest I think I had on Eat Your Heartland Out all the way back in the summer of 2020. So welcome back.
Oh, thank you. That's such an honor.
Well, it's an honor for us. And you are an absolute rock star in so many ways. And, you know, you have a really fun and interesting book that has come out this year called Company, The Radical Art of Cooking for Others. I don't need to tell you the title of your own book.
That's okay. you can state it for the others. Yes.
I will state it for the others. You know, this is what, your third book, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's your third book, but it's a little bit different than your previous ones, because this one is focused kind of on home entertaining and something that I think a lot of folks, you know, might be intimidated by, right? Because I think, you know, you think about it, oh, it's a dinner party. You have to have the nice china that you got in your like wedding registry and the candles and this and that, and, you know, slave in the kitchen for 10 hours and then you're ready, you know, almost in this kind of, you know, 1950s housewife kind of way, right? But that's not what Company is about. It, to me, it sounds like it's like the total opposite, making home entertaining accessible to all.
Yeah, absolutely. It's about making it more of a regular fixture in your life. So it's definitely, I didn't want to write anything about how people use set their table, if they use napkin rings or not, or any of those details of entertaining. There's nothing about that in this book. This book is really about, it's a menu cookbook for one thing. Right. So we're talking about full menus, you know, if that's what you need or what you want to see how like all of that stuff comes together. It's about, you know, composing a plate and, you know, the textures and the flavors and the juices that all run together on that plate in kind of a home cooking way, but also in an elevated way too, because that's where, as home cooks, that's where our creativity comes, right? In composing like those flavors and those little mini moments on a plate. But it's not about being a rock star or some sort of hero. I have one part, that one section heading that's like, we don't need to be heroes here, you know? It's about enjoying cooking for others. And I really do get into like recipes and down into the bottom of the pan, you know, like what's happening down here in the saute pan, and really just like enjoying making some things. That's what it's about.
Yeah. I mean, I think sometimes folks get stressed, myself included. I think we all get a little bit stressed and around the holidays in particular, but if, you know, you're going to have guests over, all of a sudden it's, you know, you feel like you have to put on a performance. And one of the things I really like about the vibe of Company is that it's the opposite. Like I said before, it's the opposite of putting on this performance. It's about authenticity to me. And, you know, sharing that authenticity with the people that you bring around the table. And you're helping give home cooks those tools. Walk us through a little bit. I mean, you don't have to go through the whole table of contents, but just a little bit about kind of the structure of the book.
Yeah. So I really wanted to do a menu cookbook. And there aren't that many menu cookbooks around. I have some on my shelves. There's an Alice Waters book that it's a menu cookbook, and I've always loved it. reading how do people put together the whole meal, and that was in a restaurant, of course, Chez Panisse. But when you think about entertaining or having people over or cooking for the holidays and family, the big part of your stress is what are you making all together, you right. know? Like, not just I'm going to pull this recipe from here and this one from here, but how do those moving pieces fit together? And so this book is really to do some, it does some of that work. And I think it, hopefully it'll be a relief to some people to not have to do that, right? So I've thought it all out and thought about like the processes and does this menu work as a whole to be made in one day, or if it's Thanksgiving, you know, 2 days, right?
Right.
But the book walks through, it's four big chapters. The first one is called Saturday Night, and those are your dinner parties that serve, you know, 6 to 8 people. Most of the recipes in the book are going to serve 6 to 8 people, which is mm-hmm. a really standard yield yeah. for most cookbooks. So even though there are some bigger parties at the end of the book, most of the book is just kind of a, you know, standard yields. And the second chapter, then we go right into holiday. And these are the holidays that I celebrate with my family here in Minnesota. So I actually have 2 Christmases, and I could have had 3 because my parents are divorced. You know, I could have had a lot, but I kept it to 2, my family and my husband's family. And then, you know, all kinds of different holidays. And then it goes into a chapter called Perennial Parties. Those are parties that,
you know,
parties that you throw annually that may not be hooked to a holiday. Maybe they're just like, oh, you know, I did a deer hunting menu.
I saw that. You know, coming from the Midwest, I relate.
Yeah. Do you do deer hunting? Do you have that as a holiday?
My cousin's ex-husband uh-huh. actually is like Mr. Deer Hunter. And so yeah. she ended up having to, she had like, you know, the garage freezer
yeah.
and all of the deer and venison. And so all of a sudden she's like cooking, you know, the stuff that he hunted. And she was my next door neighbor still my next door neighbor. He is not. But right. so through that, I saw her do a lot of that cooking. And that's just, you know, and I've been out to the pheasant hunt in South Dakota, for example.
Cool.
So I know that, you know, these special times of year
yes.
do, you know, it's not maybe just a birthday, but you know, or the 4th of July, but there are these kind of unique annual events. And that's why that stood out to me, because it is a very special yet annual thing that people do celebrate.
Yeah, you get it completely. I mean, and deer hunting's a really good menu to talk about, actually, because I always think of that perennial party as our real Thanksgiving in a lot of ways, because it's, you know, it's kind of our Friendsgiving. It's right before
yeah.
Thanksgiving. We get together with friends and we feast. I mean, that's a time to eat and sleep and drink. And it's quite debaucherous.
All the good stuff.
It is. But that menu, I really reached into just my kind of nerdy cooking heart to pull out the things that I really like to make. And a lot of that inspiration comes from like old French cookbooks. So,
interesting.
Yeah, we're talking about like those earthy sauces that are meat-based and red wine and, you know, kind of like muddled and marinated and things like that. And then, you know, there's like a squash bake, which by the title sounds
love.
Midwestern, but it's, you know, there's some nice dishes in that menu that I think could go any time of the year.
Yeah, no, it's, I mean, it sounds like it. I mean, and I think that the fact that you, you know, have an entertaining cookbook that doesn't focus on, you know, kind of the Emily Post, you know, manners type of, you know, this is where you put the fork and this is, you know, the tablescape. And these are, the, you know, yeah. those are the things that I think kind of stress people out sometimes. I mean, some people enjoy them and love them, certainly. But, you know, it's, you know, it seems to me that, you know, so much of what you're trying to do is get people comfortable with, you know, cooking for larger groups. You go up to well past 6 or 8 people, right, in this menu cook.
Yeah, so the last 2 chapters are like 2 big blowout parties. And I did that because, and these parties serve, one serves 15 to 20, even more, 25 you can make it. The last party is an Argentinian style asado where, now this is quite ambitious cooking, but I know that there are people who are going to want the instructions and how we do this. We've done 7 Argentinian asados at our house. And asado means it's like an open air barbecue. So you dig a pit in your yard, commitment right there. And and you take welded, like crosshatch kind of things, and you strap the meat to
it's
that.
It's like a spit. It's like a spit.
Thank you. And lean it toward the fire, and you spritz it with like a brine, a garlicky brine, and you sit by it all day. So that can be scaled up or down as ambitious or as not. You know, it doesn't have to be. I use the same brine for steaks on the grill, and it's fabulous, you know? But that kind of a thing, I have been asked over the years since my first book came out in the New Midwestern Table to 2013. I get a lot of emails and feedback from readers who say, what am I going to make for, you know, my son's graduation party? What do I make for my parents' wedding anniversary? I need something that's going to serve 20 to 25. And so that last chapter with 2 menus, it's not a huge chapter. It's not the bulk of the book, but it does have those solutions for those people. And, you know, because those occasions, they do come up and you're like, what do I do?
Yeah, no question about it. Now, I have to ask, what inspired you? How did you decide that you were going to do this big kind of Argentinian barbecue? Had you seen it someplace, or, you know, what gave you the inspiration?
Well, I've heard about it for years, but a really good friend of mine and my husband, Aaron's, some family friends, they come every year to visit. They live in upstate New York now. And his brother-in-law was Argentinian. And so my friend Chris, he learned how to do this. And so we decided, hey, let's do this thing. We want to dig a pit. We want to weld up, you know, these armatures. And, you know, my husband is a sculptor, as are many of his friends and many of the people who come to these parties. So
That helps.
They could weld those, right? And they enjoyed that kind of a project. And then I like, you know, calling my butcher and saying, hey, do you have a pig? It's my cousins are butchers. And so I would make them go down to the
auction
barn and buy it, you know, and they would buy me things, like, so it's cheap, you know. And there are ways to do these things that aren't so expensive, you know. And I have a lot of that, those kinds of tips and that awareness in this book too. But we've done 7 asados now. There's nothing more fun than sitting around barbecuing meat like that slowly. It's great.
In my head, all I'm thinking about, we have in my area in Ohio, they have an annual, one of the volunteer fire departments has this annual ox roast.
Oh my gosh.
It's just, they literally, they build a huge pit that's like in the town square. And it's just like people line up for these like ox, like roast beef sandwiches, and it's on a spit and there it is. And, you know, it's just kind of nuts. Like,
that's a big animal, Capri. That's a big animal. I've never seen that. I've only heard about it.
Crazy. It's one of the coolest things that happens. It happens every year. I think it's been going on for like 40 years now. I've been to like probably 20 of them because they're always around 4th of July weekend. And so they bring out, like, everybody goes, and because it's just like, it's a sight to see, you know, and there's really nothing like something that's like cooked all day on a spit in a pit in the middle of this town.
So I know.
These things, they really do happen. And you actually really do them. Now, outside of this last example, have you done all of these things? Were they already in your repertoire and you decided to kind of operationalize them for a cookbook? Or did you make some up and play with things to fill out some of the, you know, menus that you had already been using?
Well, a little bit of both probably, but largely this book comes out of my regular home cooking repertoire. And it's so funny because when I started thinking about what I want, I was trying to think, what do I do for my next cookbook? And, you know, I wrote as a joke to my agent, I waste so much time cooking, you know, that I can't get this proposal in. And she was like, ha ha. And I just thought about it and I thought, you know what, it is true. I'm spending a lot of time throwing dinner parties for friends. In the summertime, I live in an area where in northern Minnesota, where it's pretty remote, where we don't get a lot of visitors during the winter, but during the summer, everybody comes home. And so it's like,
absolutely,
you know, week after week. And so I started to think, I should just be doing these, you know? And in some sense,
kill two birds with one stone.
Yeah. Like, in a weird way, I was thinking, oh, this isn't fancy enough. You know, this is too simple. Because some of the menus, when you're talking about a menu and a plate, you have like maybe a great, you know, let's say you have this great meat dish or something, and, you know, it's like stellar, it's tons of flavor and a starchy side. But, you know, some of the vegetables on the plate are going to be kind of simple. Like,
yeah,
with my fried chicken, which is like a double dipped, you know, fried chicken, really great crust. But, you know, and it's cream corn. But then it's like green beans with butter and garlic, you know, in the summer. There's nothing better.
Nothing better.
So there are some vegetable recipes and some other recipes in this book that can be very simple. So I really have a range because, you know, you have to have like a rhythm section on your plate. It can't be all like, ah, rah, rah, you know? And
I love that analogy.
Yeah. You know how cookbooks now are kind of like always, like they're like digital singles in a sense, you know? Like this recipe goes viral. Bang. This is big flavor. Wow. And then we just leave, you know, home cooks to kind of pull all the other things together. But this book does have some softer elements too, and simpler.
Well, and you know, you mentioned earlier about how, you know, you thought about how these things come together on the plate. Mm-hmm. You know, what kind of elements, you know, sometimes things are a little bit more obvious where, you know things are going to be kind of a cacophony of flavors if you put them on a plate. But how do you kind of decide, aha, this is the perfect bite. This is the perfect textures and colors and bringing those things together. Like, when do you know that that plate has been composed in a way that is going to be, you know, kind of bringing all those flavors, making them all shine, but at the same time, when they come together, they're their own, you know, kind of main event.
Yeah. I mean, through trial and error, just by doing it. And, and all of these menus I've made so many times altogether. This book, I just, you know, personally tested it a million times. Like, for instance, the fried chicken menu. So you have fried chicken and, you know, the creamed corn. It's got a little bit of cream. It's got a little bit of coconut, so it's a little lighter, you know, but still creamy. And I do some grating of the corn, so it's really – it's kind of a looser one. And then, you know, cooked greens with that. So good. And they're braised with, like – bacon and tomato and a little, you know, paprika. So they're a little smoky. My grandmother's very thinly sliced. They're like it's almost like a pickle. It's a vinegar, like a vinegar cuke, right?
Yeah.
Somewhere between a side dish and a condiment, this pickle lies, you know. It's a very Midwestern thing.
I was going to say, there's a lot of that sort of like, you know, it's an olive, like, you know, there's all these kind of things like, is it a side dish? Is it a condiment? Is it a garnish? We're not sure.
Yeah. So that this menu, this plate has a little bit of that, you know, and then the green beans, you know, and if you want dessert after all that, you know, there's dessert.
We haven't talked about dessert. Let's talk about dessert.
Yes.
So, yeah. So what do you have on offer as part of these, you know, on your menus? What kind of desserts are you bringing? Are you suggesting?
Well, I can tell you, I mean, there's a chocolate cake in this book that I'm very proud of. I tested it a gazillion times. It can be made. It's not flourless, but yet it's very dense. Okay, so it's a very traditional French chocolate cake in that it has just a little bit of flour, you know? And it also has, I use just like regular semi-sweet grocery store chocolate, but I want it to taste like, oh, you know, one of those $10 or $12 chocolate bars, you know, the ones that have tasting notes that are like coffee that's like, this is a little bit, this chocolate tastes like, you know,
it's like the back of a wine bottle, but it's a chocolate bar. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's like citrusy and bright and this and that. And so I added like tangerine juice and bourbon and some dark sweet spices and all of this to this chocolate cake that has just a little bit of flour. So it's chewy and dense. And then it sits and you kind of press it a little bit so it's even denser. And then you pore in the indentation in the top that's like just slightly caved in as it should be, a little bit fallen. Then you pour that, you know, full of chocolate ganache that sets to like a, you know, a fudge that's sliceable. Wow. And you can make it with buckwheat flour, which I think almost tastes almost a little better in a weird way. But the AP regular white flour has more chew. So I give both variations. But I like that cake, and you can make one of them, and you can make it a day ahead, and you can slice it very thinly because it's rich.
Yeah, that sounds like it's like, you know, a few bites, it would take me out. Like, fantastic, but like, you know, I have like such a like low threshold for super rich. But yeah. I mean, you know, you like, it's like you go for that fourth bite because it's going to be so good. And then you're like, oh man, I feel sick.
Yeah. Well, it goes down surprisingly light. But, you know, that's the kind of thing I like to have sweets. Actually, the next day, I like, that's my lunch. I'll be like, what I'm having for lunch today is a piece of chocolate cake with whipped cream.
Why not? Yay. Why not? Now, do you talk at all about leftovers? I mean, you know, and how to use them?
Not a ton. Although my life, I mean, that's my life. We have leftovers like crazy. I do talk about how to make things ahead, how to plan your time in that sense. But I also do talk about what you can do with what's left over. What is the next best thing to do and to roll the leftover into, you know? I live very far from a town or a restaurant, so that's my world.
do you think that, you know, kind of being out in northern Minnesota and, you know, having to source things in advance or locally and seasonally, has that informed, you know, how you've developed these menus as well?
Yeah, I think it informs my cooking, you know, because I spent, let's say I'm from here. I spent 10 years in New York City. And right. I've been back here in Minnesota, northern Minnesota, for 15 years. It's changed my cooking so much. In some ways, it's really weird because in the summer, I have access to the most beautiful produce anywhere, you know, orchard fruits, garden stuff. I always have access to great meat from local farms. Mm-hmm. Like, those things are very easy for me. Like, capers are hard. You know, or like in salt, or certain definitely imported things can be hard for me to source.
Sure.
And so the rest of the year, 9 months of the year when we're not, you know, or 7 months of the year when nothing's growing in the garden, I cook out of the regular grocery store and, you know, from a town that's not that big, right? So, but we have a co-op, you know, there's like a natural
co-op. That's amazing.
People around here really care about food. And I think that's a misconception about the Midwest, like a judgment, like, oh, people just eat out of whatever. No, I think, you know, if somebody's driving, you know, 25 miles to go get the best chickens, you know, they care. They care about food. We're driving all over to try to get things and, you know, oh, I have too many cabbages. Will you bring this to so-and-so? You know, there's a lot of that. And it's a beautiful thing.
Totally. And, you know, you hit the nail on the head. It's one of our first conversations that we had, you know, about how you define Midwestern food and how, you know, sort of the Midwestern palate and what Midwestern foodways are have been somewhat, you know, stereotyped in a way that has created some misconceptions. And, you know, I can understand why there's a lot of association with industrial food in the Midwest, partially because of, you know, many of the manufacturers and obviously, you know, the quote unquote breadbasket of America and all these things that, you know, sure are true, but there's so much more to the Midwestern food story. And that's why I love the work that you do, because, you know, you really do capture those contours in a very genuine way. And then you get to share them with everybody else by putting out books, which is amazing.
Yeah. Thanks. I mean, you think about Minnesota and Minneapolis and Archer, you know, General Mills, Betty Crocker, you know, they really did. There's a lot of industrial food, but at the same time, I also think about like the incredible ad campaign that was going on to convert people to buy it, you know, and it took a lot of persuasion. And there still are people, like my grandmother was to the end, she just did not trust things that were made in factories, you know? Mm-hmm. I mean, she had certain things she liked, you know, certain canned things, but, and she was from the 50s, but there was a distrust of that. Like, it was secondary to that your own knowledge in your family. You know, like we knew how to make things. We knew how to grow things.
And you know how to can things too.
I never really canned with her, but she did. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. My mom was like, oh, I'm not canning, which, you know, that's great.
I think there's a huge gap there. I think that there has a lot of this, whether it's gardening or canning, you know, locally sourcing the slow food movement, all of these kind of catchy things that are out. I think that a lot of it really did skip some of the boomers and has, you know, kind of come up through Gen X, millennials and on down the line where, you know, for whatever reason, and we see this, I think, in a lot of things, even with people that have like, you know, decided that they're not going to speak their native tongue at home. They're like, we're speaking English. And then all of a sudden, you know, the grandkids and on were like, no, we want to go back and we want to learn, you know, about our heritage and you know, the language. And so I think that there is this growing appreciation for ways in which, you know, things were done the old fashioned way. But I think that there's an appreciation for that value there.
Oh, absolutely. But also, you know, it takes time. And the reason that people did that was because they didn't have money. And but then that's where those arts come out of, right? Those beautiful skills, those rich skills. And it's kind of wild how it goes back and forth. I know we could talk for hours about that, just that topic, I think.
Well, the microwave does not create any skills.
No.
Is what we've learned is that, you know, single serving microwave deals are not going to create, you know, incredible skills and, you know, robust culture to pass on from one generation to the next.
No. And that's why, you know, like my recipes and the methods get longer and longer because it's really about describing how things look, feel, smell, taste, the texture, you know. Like those things, there's just so much to know, you know? And like my son, people are like, oh, do you teach your son how to cook? Does he have a knife and I'm like, not really, but he watches me, you know?
Right.
And that's all he needs to do. I never really picked up a knife too much with my mom, but I watched her and I went to the store with her and I learned which lemons were the ones to buy and which lettuces was the ones to buy. And all these things, there's so much, you know?
That's right. And you know, kids are sponges and they learn by observation. And I just find it really interesting what you were saying just about, you know, how you're describing these methods in these really detailed manners, because there is so much in recipes that, you know, seems so, I don't even know how to put it, just not just methodical, but very sterile, right? It's a half cup of this and 3/4 tablespoon of that and this and that. And like, okay, well, that's great. You can follow a recipe to the T, but something is off still. You're like, I don't know what it is, but it's just off.
Yeah.
And then,
you know,
making it your own. And so it is about trying to find those taste memories and those smells and textures and all of that.
Well, you know, recipe writing has become standardized in the past, you know, 10, 20, 30 years.
True.
And so, you know, if you write a recipe and then you put it, you know, you submit for a magazine or you know, they put it in their, what they quote, style, right? And my editor, I love her. She's like, yeah, we're not doing, I'm like, I don't want to do that. I want to write my own voice. And so I didn't have to do the standardization because I would much rather put that visual clue, that cue, that what it should look and feel like and everything before the time, the number. I think that there's too much reliance on numbers. And when we get to that place where we're like, it's exactly 5 to 8 minutes at 350, you know, what it does is it makes us question our intuition. Because it's a machine. It's an oven. It doesn't necessarily, mine is not necessarily exactly like yours.
I was just going to say, you know, I mean, and it could be a gas stove versus an electric stove versus an induction stove. There is, you know, there's the inconsistencies and the different types of pots or pans, you know,
that makes a huge difference.
A huge difference, right? You know, as far as what it, you know, how it's conducting the heat and how it's holding on to the heat, all of those things can play a huge role in with the final product. So I love that. Like, you don't want a recipe to harsh your vibe when it comes to intuition.
Yes, your intuition is everything. Like, that's what we're getting into, is that flow and trusting ourselves to say, I know this isn't right. I'm going to do this. You know, so my recipes just go longer and longer because I have, of course, I have all the numbers and I have all of the, you know, the what we're supposed to have. But I also have a lot of, you know, description, because I really think that that's the way to go. You know, a professional chef, I worked in kitchens for 10 years. You don't even know what temperature the oven's at. You know, it's like, is that a hot oven? Is it a really hot oven? Is it a somewhat hot oven? And, you know, I got a wood cook stove a few years ago because I wanted to cook like my grandmother had. And
that's awesome.
It's the same kind of thing. It's like, is it hot? Is it warm? Is it, you know, and you have to like throw sticks of wood into it. You know, it's, there's no, I could never make a cookbook from that. There is no cookbook to be made. It's ridiculous. You know, you really go by intuition with that.
Well, look, and if you look at, you know, the old recipes, like I actually, during the pandemic, was going through a lot of like historic cookbooks. So there was like the suffragette cookbook, essentially, that had a bunch of recipes that were, contributed by women all across the United States and in the effort to raise money for, you know, the women's suffrage movement. Anyway, you go through that and there are, you know, obviously they're not at 350 degrees because they're not, you know, cooking in an oven. The units of measurement are different. You know, it's, you really had to improvise. And so if you're looking at a recipe from, you know, the 19th century or previous, or even, you know, early 20th century, you're not going to get this kind of reliance on numbers, as you were saying.
No, not at all. They're very short because they assume that everybody knows how to do things. And, you know, we don't, they also probably, things didn't turn out as well though, for that reason. So there are good things about recipes that are more detailed today. But I don't know, I think there is a line where you start to question your intuition. I think there's a lot of pride in being able to know when something's done, you know?
Absolutely. And a lot of pride, I think, in sharing that and sharing that joy with others, as you would, you know, if you're, you know, having people over.
Yeah. I mean, I want everybody to make all these recipes their own. And I don't even care if you give me credit, you know, like that was my grandmother. That's how they did it. You know, somebody would make something, they'd rewrite it in their own hand on an index card and it was theirs. That's it. You know, there's no copyright on a recipe, you know?
I love how you approach all of this. And I love how you've approached, you know, making home entertaining accessible. If people want to grab this book, company, where can they find it?
Pretty much anywhere books are sold. Right now, it's been released very widely and, it's all over, you know, but you can go to my website or you can find it on Amazon. I love bookshop.org.
It's one of my new favorite places. Bookshop.org is awesome. Yep.
Yes. They give money to independent bookstores. I love my local independent bookstore in Park Rapids, Minnesota. If you contact them, I can personalize a copy. I'll walk down there and they'll pop it in the mail.
That's awesome. What's the name of that? What's the name of that shop?
It's called Beagle and Wolf Books and Bindery. You can call Jen or Sally.
I love it.
Yes, but all over, you know, you can find me on the internet. You can find the book on the internet. Also, anthropology.com is selling the book as well.
That's right. They do some really great collaborations with, you know, home entertaining and that sort of thing. That is just great. It has been so fun, as always, to talk with you, Amy. And yes, I know that our listeners are going to be happy to hear from you again as well. Pick up a copy of Company. Amy, don't be a stranger. We'll definitely have you back again soon.
Capri, that was a great conversation. Thank you so much for having me on.
This is Eat Your Heartland Out with me, Capri Cafaro. After the break, I'll welcome another Midwestern food rock star. Paul Feuerbach is up next. Paul, welcome.
Thanks for having me, Capri.
Absolutely. It is my pleasure because, you know, from what I know of you, I think you and I share a lot of the same mission when it comes to, you know, I think bringing some education around Midwestern food to the rest of the country. And you are a Midwestern native, growing up in Southern Indiana. How did your upbringing and, you know, coming from the Midwest inform your path into the culinary world?
Well, I grew up in a very rural part of Indiana. I mean, Indiana is a largely rural state, but in a town and county where there was a lot of old line farms when I was growing up, people still had diversified farms where there were pigs in the yard and a chicken coop. And they'd also have dairy cows and cattle they were raising for meat. And food was very much part of community life, which I guess you could always say that is true any time of year, any place that food is part of community life. But there it was, food production was very much a part of community and family life day to day, because we were raising our food. Most of the people around us were raising our food. And so it was very seasonal, one, and that's extremely important in informing me and how I like to cook and approach food. You eat strawberries in June because that's when you have them.
Right.
And you eat squirrels in October because that's when the state says you can go out and hunt them. So definitely a very seasonal approach, definitely very fresh ingredients because, again, there were kitchen gardens. Most people canned at home. While I was growing up in the 70s, that was changing pretty rapidly. A lot of the people who had these old line farms were passing on, and their kids didn't want to continue that work and, you know, went into different fields, and these farms just gradually were converting to big corn and soybean operations. And at the same time, you know, the town was really excited that a giant corporation at that time, I don't know if it was global yet, but a giant corporation noticed our little town called McDonald's and decided to open a restaurant there. And so the fast food restaurants started to move in, and it was convenient. When I taste that stuff now, you know, if you go and eat at a KFC or a McDonald's, I always wonder, you know, how could anybody who grew up eating this real food just fall for that so easily?
Right.
But we did. And, you know, so a lot of the inspiration for writing Midwestern Food was sort of witnessing that. And the continued decline and decay of these old food ways. And as my parents were getting older and aunts and uncles, I wanted to document as much of that as I could, because that story of the rural Midwest, people have talked about the rural South, is that story's been told. It continues to be told about the foods that they eat in that culture, the Northeast, every other part of the country. It seems like that story's been told. Yep. And the preservation of those foodways is considered important in all of these other parts of the country. And that hasn't really taken hold in the Midwest. And I wanted to kind of get some document work done about it. And that was sort of what started this book. And it kind of grew from there as I realized that there's a lot going on around the entire Midwest, and these stories that haven't been told or are misunderstood or being mistold, which is even worse than having, having a wrong story or, you know, some incorrect or blatantly false legend or lore about something, is almost worse than not even telling the story, because it obscures the real people behind the foods that we're eating. So I wanted to get word out about the Midwest and kind of correct the record and start from a set of facts. And recipes are facts. And I chose the format of a cookbook because recipes tell stories. And I used almost all of the recipes came from somewhere or someone else, because it's their story, not mine. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to let the recipes speak for themselves. But so that's why I chose the format of a cookbook. It's what I'm comfortable with. And I think that it recipes tell a story in a very powerful way.
I couldn't agree with you more, Paul. I mean, you're speaking my language on so many different levels that, you know, food and recipes, they have a unique storytelling capability. And that the Midwest itself is, you know, by and large, very misunderstood when it comes to, you know, its food ways. And because of that, you know, I think the desire for preservation has really been overlooked in, or at least obscured and definitely eclipsed by a number of other regional food ways, as you mentioned, the South, Northeast, et cetera. So I'm curious to know how you started. You said, you know, you wanted to kind of try to document, you know, these things. How did you start to embark on this process? What was your methodology?
Well, it was really just picking my dad's brain and recording that stuff on voice memos on my phone and writing things down later when I got a chance. And my Aunt Rita and mom. And so, you know, to get as many of these stories as I could, and also reading just community cookbooks, which I've read voraciously from different parts of the Midwest, and tried to sort of understand what was going on. And, you know, it's always really fascinating to hear Dad talk about the farm, because Dad had a very keen memory about everything, not just farm life. He was a school teacher for years. And could read a book and tell you all about it. You know, just right after reading it, he just would remember things in a phenomenal long-term memory. So I could ask him about, you know, what they did with all the different parts of the pig when they did their annual hog killings, you know, how Grandpa cured the ham and, you know, when they smoked it and, you know, tell me about the wild cherry wine again. And those types of things. So I would record these stories and write them down. And a lot of these actually at the end of the day didn't make it into the book because and they'll be written and documented somewhere else. I haven't decided where yet. I wanted to make the cookbook as approachable as possible because an important part of preserving foodways is for people to eat them and to make the foods. So if I set out a bunch of recipes, you know, from a German-American hog killing day where they're making the liver sausage and the things they're doing with the intestines and the head cheese and all of that. It's probably not a lot of people are going to make those things. And we are fortunate in the West, I think, at least to this day, to have little local butcher shops all over the place that are still cooking or that are still making a lot of these recipes for sausages and cured meats the same way that they've been making them for generations. So you don't have to kill the hog and process it yourself. You can go to a butcher shop probably nearby and get a lot of the same things that, you know, Grandpa was doing on his farm. So I'll be publishing that stuff in another book at some point. But, you know, like I adapted Grandpa's wild cherry wine recipe, for instance, was one of them that did make the book. But I had to adapt it from a 55-gallon barrel to something that was a little bit more practical for people to do at home. And my grandma's cherry pie or strawberry custard pie, Springerly cookies, all of these things that people used to have, you know, at least once a year for generations that maybe aren't as common anymore.
Right. But I mean, you know, in the process of putting them out there again, I mean, you are playing that part of preservation and continuing to have those, you know, those recipes passed down from generation to generation. How did you do the research outside of your own personal experiences, having these conversations with your father and your aunt and family members, but, you know, going into these other parts of the Midwest and capturing the sentiment and the food ways of those areas that maybe you weren't as intimately, you know, familiar with?
I mean, I did a lot of travel in the course of writing the book. And, you know, the first thing I would do would be to read about the city in advance, either through guidebooks or through local interest publications, and try to get either through, so I would read about the city in advance, either in guidebooks or in local interest publications, which are pretty easy to find in almost any town. So even after I would like before I went to Cincinnati, I found Dan Wollert's books. He did a fantastic book on Cincinnati chili and one on Cincinnati wine, which is a really fascinating history. People don't realize that Cincinnati was the original wine capital of North America, and really the entire California wine industry was seeded by the wine industry that had grown up around around Cincinnati. Really fascinating history there. So I was able to do a lot of this reading before I even went to, say, for instance, Cincinnati. But I knew chefs and writers there, Justin Dean and Jed Portman particularly, who were able to point me in directions. Justin Dean, I featured in the book because he's doing really cool work on a farm now. He's no longer a restaurant chef, God bless him. And so in those instances, I was in almost every city, I was able to pick the brains of chefs that I'd met at events around the country. Rob Conley in St. Louis and Kim and Gavin Kaysen in Minneapolis and so forth. So it was so there was a fair amount of reconnaissance beforehand, but you know, you never underestimate the power of sitting at a hotel bar and asking the bartender what they like and what they think is really cool around town.
Absolutely. I mean, there's no substitute for, suggestions from the locals. And, you know, I noticed in your book, you have a number of meet the locals as, you know, part of your different sections throughout the cookbook. You mentioned Rob Conley is one of them, who actually has been a guest on this program previously. How many places did you actually physically go to collect information for this cookbook?
I think it would be hard to count. Cincinnati, I probably pretty much went through Columbus. I didn't really do justice. Cleveland, Detroit, obviously Chicago, Grand Rapids, Madison, Milwaukee. I didn't really get up to the North Woods. I was writing this during COVID. And so these personal profiles, I wanted to do a lot more of them. I think I had 12 of them slated. That turned out to be difficult, but also just travel was kind of
sure.
I was one of the COVID the people who was really extremely adamant that I never get COVID, and so I was extremely cautious, and it inhibited a lot of travel. I never got to the North Woods of Wisconsin or Minnesota, but I did Minneapolis, Iowa City, and I didn't get out to Sioux City. And St. Louis was maybe one of my favorite trips. I think that's a terribly underrated.
Amen. I agree.
It's a terribly underrated food town. And of course, I'm from Southern Indiana. I've been in, you know, Central Illinois and Indiana, the whole state have kind of been my domain for a long, long time. My partner is from, South Central Illinois. So we get through Illinois a lot and get through Indiana all the time. I spent a fair amount of time in Louisville, which I kind of consider a Midwestern city. It's technically on the other side of the border.
I get it. That's how I feel about Pittsburgh and Buffalo.
I actually wanted to get to Pittsburgh and it just didn't happen. And it's one of the things that nobody's really pointed out yet about the book that maybe hard to pick up on was that at the beginning of the book, when I sort of define the Midwest and I look at, you know, the ethnic groups and the topography and, you know, Pittsburgh gets put squarely in the Midwest. And Buffalo actually belongs in the Midwest. Those cities have more in common demographically and also historically in terms of their importance. Absolutely. As industrial cities. and existence as part of the Rust Belt. There's a very common experience between those cities and, say, you know, St. Louis or Cincinnati, Milwaukee. And so those cities belong in the Midwest, but and they've actually got a lot of really interesting food in both of those cities. And I just didn't get there.
It's something that, you know, we grapple with as well, working with this program is, you know, how rigid do we want to go with quote unquote geographic boundaries? And, you know, there are X amount of states that are considered part of the Midwest, but you do have to consider those cultural, you know, affinities. And, you know, I come from Northeastern Ohio and, you know, I'm a short drive from both Buffalo and Pittsburgh. And there's no question that those communities, and so I've included voices from Pittsburgh and from Buffalo, even though, you know, people don't check those boxes as, you know, Western Pennsylvania and upstate New York. And sometimes, and then you have those, that fluidity when you talk about Louisville, we have the fluidity as well of that interface with Appalachia in this neck of the woods too, with Pittsburgh and the Three Rivers and the Panhandles of West Virginia. And so you get a little bit of that happening. So there are, you know, interesting nuances in trying to define food ways, and they're really not necessarily, you know, easy to put in a box, which is, you know, what really struck me about the way that you approached your cookbook is that it shows, you know, the fact that Midwestern food is not some sort of monolith, which I think is, you know, the common misconception amongst people that may not be from, you know, a community that might be considered in the Midwest, that, you know, it isn't, although you do have a chapter or a section on meat and potatoes and state fairs, two things that, you know, state fairs, tailgates and Main Street cafes, definitely things that I think folks associate, you know, by and large with the Midwest. But, you know, there's a lot of really interesting stuff in here that touches upon the you know, cultural diversity, ethnic diversity. How did you make your short list? And then I want to ask you about some of your recipes in here, but how did you narrow these recipes down to say, okay, these are the ones that are going to make the cut?
That's actually a really good question. And it was one that pained me a lot. You know, I have a list of recipes that I didn't get in the book, just because of space. By the time I was contracted for 90,000 words. By the time I got to 100, my editor was like, come on. And then we got to 110 and he's like, whoa, whoa, whoa. And by the time we got to 120, it was just like, you stop, you're done. Because you also want to put the more pages and the more weight the book is, the less affordable and approachable it is.
Yeah.
And so we really had to stop short of what, you know, might have otherwise been, and there can always be and likely will be another volume of Midwestern food that goes into more obscure and more, visiting, you know, the little burgs and really kind of getting out of the mainstream of the Midwest. As far as deciding what would go in, I actually had drawn a big sort of, I don't know if I would call it a tree, but I had, you know, I hadn't even really figured out what I wanted the chapters to be or how to approach it. Because Midwestern food is so much different from, say, Southern food or New England cuisine, in that it really developed and became a cuisine concurrently with industrialization. And that's not just the industrialization of, automated manufacturing processes and automobiles, but it was also the industrialization of food and dual income households. So things like casseroles are obviously very important. They were time savers, and they also exploited the new industrial food system in order to feed people inexpensively, nutritiously, and with minimal tax in terms of time on the household. And, you know, we're primarily talking about women who were doing the cooking throughout our history. So minimal tax on women in terms of, you know, getting dinner on the table while there were so many other things going on. So I started this kind of these big splotches of, you know, these are foods that we eat with our hands, and, you know, these are, you know, foods that we eat while we're snacking, And these are, you know, definitely like sit down and have dinner kinds of foods. And, you know, these are the pies and the cakes. And, you know, so I would put foods in these and take foods out of them. And as I took foods out of them, I would put them in another list, which I still have, that goes, you know, like I said, for probably some sort of volume two. You know, it was really my intuition more than anything else, although I did have some discussion with certain friends who are really into food, about whether things like, you know, Western Kentucky or Owensboro barbecue should be included. And that's the mutton barbecue of Western Kentucky that you find. Mm-hmm. It's the Ohio River Valley, essentially. Yep. Kind of the Midwest. And ultimately, I left it out. Again, that could probably go in some sort of second volume. I was really encouraged by everybody to put that in. And at the end of the day, I felt like this book, making a lot of the claims I'm making, you know, sort of taking fried chicken and saying, hey, the South, this isn't just yours, this is also ours. Making a lot of the claims that I was making, that I had to make this book bulletproof.
Yeah.
And if I started, you know, tipping over perceived borders and boundaries, it was definitely better to just stay north of the Ohio River.
Yep. No, that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. So, I mean, and that didn't really inform. I mean, I would have gone to Pittsburgh because I love Pittsburgh. I've been there, you know, a few times, but it's been many years. I just didn't make it.
Well, as you said, we got another volume, right? So you can come back anytime.
Yeah, absolutely.
What I'm seeing here is, I'm looking at some of these, and I want to kind of ask a little bit about, you know, some of the actual individual recipes. Just as, you know, if you're a lay person looking through this and, you know, you're trying to find, you know, a recipe to make, and you see something like watermelon pickles or pink squirrel under, you know, cocktails, or I'm going to butcher this, Apfelklutchen, you know, under breads. And then you see, you know, I noticed some interesting regional ingredients. You have sorghum, pecan sticky rolls, and I saw pawpaw pie further down, you know, and then you have things like latkes and, of course, you know, obvious things like chicken and noodles, and the bane of my personal existence, Cincinnati chili, Queen City chili, you have it here. Just so many, you know, different types of food and recipes that give you a sense of, like I said earlier, the differences and the complexities of Midwestern foodways. You know, what would you say is maybe the most, I don't know, off the wall out of all of these? If you like, I mean, I'm looking at this here, cranberry and bone marrow pudding pie. Now that's a combination I don't think I would have come up with. Where did this come from?
That actually came from, that was one of the very, very few recipes in the book. That and the pawpaw pie are two recipes that are pretty much just mine, and that I've done at my restaurant, which is ostensibly a Southern restaurant. You know, the pawpaw I definitely wanted to include because it is our largest native fruit. And it was actually during colonization and during settlement, I guess. You know, they would publish all of these pamphlets and books that were targeted at Europeans.
Mm-hmm.
To entice them to emigrate to the United States. It's really, you know, it's kind of macabre thinking about it now, and because of what was going on concurrently with the treatment of the First Nations here.
Absolutely.
But, you know, they were really trying to make it sound like such a rich and abundant land, which it was. But pawpaws were always, and persimmons actually were always hyped up in these pamphlets and books that were published for Europeans. I guess maybe because they were like these strange exotic things that people would be able to enjoy when they got here. But pawpaw, there are no traditional recipes. It's always been a difficult fruit to cook with. And it's, you know, that's something that I've cracked, myself. A code that I've cracked, I guess, that I've figured out a few recipes that do work with pawpaws, and I wanted to include something so people could get cooking with them. The cranberry and bone marrow pie actually came from an Appalachian cookbook, but it was up in West Virginia, which is definitely maybe South Tidewater, but actually very close to Ohio. And I was just fascinated by it, a bone marrow custard pie. And, you know, I made it once at the restaurant and I thought, God, this is just too rich. And, you know, taking a page from my grandmother's cooking with that strawberry custard pie, which I think is the very first sweet recipe, if I recall. I thought, you know, this bone marrow pie could use some sort of fruit. And I used blackberries because that was what was in season at the time. And good wild blackberries have a nice sourness to them. And it was just great. You'd have this really, 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 really rich, unctuous, aromatic bone marrow, sort of tempered by the fruit, which in the context of the custard sort of becomes, you know, almost something you slurp. It's like, I don't know, it's hard to describe, like a creme brulee like texture. Just really good stuff. And so I just decided I wanted to include that recipe as a cranberry recipe, because that's maybe my favorite version of it now that I've cooked it with. You know, I've cooked it with rhubarb, I've cooked it with peaches. And so, you know, something to use cranberries, which cranberries are actually native to the Midwest. It's something that I think a lot of people know.
Wisconsin.
Don't know. Yep, Wisconsin particularly. And the Midwest probably produces more cranberries at this point than New England does. You know, the big ocean spray, the big cranberry concern is from Massachusetts. So, you know, I guess that sort of informs people's picture of that, but it's definitely a Midwestern fruit. And so I wanted to include a cranberry dessert because people don't use cranberries enough. For one of our native berries, they don't use them enough. And so, yeah, I sort of put those two ideas together and came up with that pie.
It's funny that I landed on, as I'm just going through this list, landed on two that actually, you know, you created. What about ones, we started this conversation, you saying that, you know, most of the recipes in your book don't come from you because it's not necessarily your story to tell, even though you're a chef, you know, and obviously you're trained in the kitchen. A lot of these recipes come from other sources. What would you say is the most unique out of those that, you know, are not necessarily ones that you developed on your own?
Oh, sure. That's actually really easy. And it's still, I mean, even to people in Chicago where it used to be a thing are like, it's a what? Is the barbecued snoot from St. Louis. And they used to be a thing too on Chicago's south side. Chicago and St. Louis, as you might imagine, there's just one big highway and used to be a railroad line that went between the two. There's a lot of commonality in the urban cuisines, particularly in the Black communities, because both of them are also connected deeply to the Delta region and New Orleans. So pig snoots used to be something in Chicago as well on the south side, but you can't find them here anymore. Although in St. Louis, you can still find maybe a dozen places that do them. And it's not, as you might think, the actual nose of the pig. It's the skin flap from over that goes over the snout. And most people who barbecue them cut the actual, what's the pink patty thing that's the actual snout, right? That actually gets cut off. And so you have, it's basically the skin and gristle and fat that gets cut off of the bridge of the pig's snout. And it's, you know, probably about the size, you know, of a washcloth, about half the size of a washcloth, maybe, and size of an 8.5 by, or, you know, size of an envelope that you might put a letter in. And you marinate this in salt water with vinaigrette or hot sauce overnight. And then it just gets a really low and slow cook over, you know, coals is the way to do it. If you're going to call it barbecue, some people nowadays just do it on a gas grill and it's just not the same. But, you know, you can do it with charcoal. You don't need to go and you don't need to burn a fire of hickory wood and then scoop over the coals like, you know, quote unquote, real barbecue. Charcoal is actually, you know, this charcoal you buy at the store actually cuts that process out. You're actually just buying the embers. So you can actually barbecue over charcoal. Don't let anybody tell you you have to have wood. But so you over the coals, you cook this snoot and you've constantly turning it. And, you know, around 215, 225 degrees is the best place to keep it. But after several hours of just slowly turning these over and over, they gradually cook, render out. They lose all of their fat and the skin cooks and starts to become very tender. But then it, just like a chicharron, because it's dried out also as part of this process, it starts to sort of puff up and get really crunchy, crispy. And so it takes several hours, but it's like a big chicharron that is just tastes of barbecue. And they're just fantastic. But they're really hard to find. I think people are just turned off by the whole idea of a snoot. So in Chicago, you can get the rib tip and hot link combo is sort of the thing in the South Side barbecue. In East St. Louis, you can get the rib tip and snoot combo, which is what I would get when I go down there, because that's actually an even better combo than the tip and link, because the rib tips, if you've ever had them, have this really, yeah, they're cartilaginous, but there's also like the rendered fat in them is really, really creamy. The meat is toothsome. Mm-hmm. It's got this real tactile, textural experience that goes with it. There's so many textures involved. And then you take this snoot, which is just crunchy. It's like eating pig rinds. It literally is a pig rind. It's just one you cooked over a... coals. And so you have this crispy, crunchy, you know, toothsome meat and slurpy sauce and, you know, everything, the cartilaginous tips and all of these textures. It's just a masterpiece. And I think speaks to the ingenuity and brilliance of, you know, of soul food cooks and of cooks in dispossessed communities that we have here in the Midwest, how people can be so resourceful with things like pig snoots and the tossed ends of racks of ribs.
No question about it. I mean, it's that resourcefulness is definitely, I think, a characteristic in many parts of the Midwest. And I also have to say that I so appreciate your attention to descriptive detail in all of this, given the fact that this is radio and it's hard sometimes to grasp things that, you know, it have those, that tactile aspect and of course all of the senses involved in food. So those descriptions were incredibly useful, I think, and definitely are going to drew me in, and I'm sure are drawing our listeners in as well. The snoot conversation, though, makes me think that it might not be the most approachable of the recipes in your book. It might not be one, you know, an ingredient that's accessible to many. So if you were to give a suggestion to, you know, a reader of your cookbook who is looking to for a place to start, some place that might be a low barrier to entry to start to get to know the recipes in the book and better understand Midwestern cuisine, where would you tell them to start?
Oh, well, Midwesterners love to bake. So I would definitely, and sweets were always, you know, of any community event, the sweets were always the highlight. And, you know, women, whether you're in an inner city church or a country church, And, you know, if you have the church bake sale or a church supper where everybody's bringing their desserts, it's almost sort of an unspoken competition where everyone is trying to show off their best. And so I would say a great and very, very approachable place to start is with my grandma's the strawberry custard pie. It's really easy. You can even start with a store-bought pie shell if you must. And otherwise, it's very, very easy. You can make it with any fruit. It's, again, this time of year, I would make it with cranberries. We're getting into cranberry season, but it works really well with frozen strawberries. And it works really well with frozen blackberries. Those are my two favorite fruits to make it with, is strawberries or blackberries. That's a really good one to start with. And I would say also, you know, for something to snack on, if you have a food processor, make the cold pack cheese. It's really easy, and it will dispel all of the myths you have of being some really sinister industrial product, because real cold pack cheese is nothing more than two different cheeses blended together without the application of heat. So a good brand of cold pack cheese, like Pine River, the original one, I have some of it in my refrigerator here, is that there's nothing in it but cheese and a little bit of cream to bind it. It's really easy to make. The fried cheese curds are really easy to make. If you can get cheese curds, which may be hard in certain other parts of the country, but I think they're becoming easier to find.
They are.
Throughout the Midwest. So, you know, those are certainly two big ones that I think aren't too hard to make.
Those are some good suggestions. You know, you've given us a little bit of sweet and a little bit of savory. I think a lot to think about when it comes to what Midwestern cuisine is, where it comes from, how complex it is, how special it is. I don't know about you, but I'm going to hold you to the fact that you're going to come out with like another volume of this, because I am certainly not done with, the options that are out there when it comes to Midwestern food. And it sounds like you got a whole lot of things that were left on the cutting floor that need a home. So you better come out with another volume.
That's the plan at this time.
That is great. Paul, I am so glad that you had time to come join the program. Paul Fehrbach, the chef and owner of Big Jones in Chicago and the author of Midwestern Food, A Chef's Guide to the Surprising History of a Great American Cuisine, with more than 100 tasty recipes. And obviously there are more than 100, which is why we're going to get another volume. Everybody go check this book out. Paul, thank you for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Capri. It was a great time.
You've been listening to Eat Your Heartland Out. This episode was produced by me, Capri Cafaro. Our audio engineers are Liam Warner and Armin Spengen. Theme music by Jason Shaw. You can learn more about the show by visiting heritageradionetwork.org/Eat Your Heartland Out. Eat Your Heartland Out is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. Keep in touch at heritageradionetwork.org/subscribe.
Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.